Emmy Award-winning musician, author, and philanthropist Peter Buffett has been performing a concert and conversation all over the United States, Canada, and China since 2010. He'll be performing on Tuesday, March 3rd at 5:30 at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. He'll sing, play piano with cellist Michael Cott. Also, he'll be telling stories about growing up, career choice, and philanthropic learning while taking questions from the audience throughout the show. It is a great pleasure to welcome Peter Buffett to Studio A this morning. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Great to be here.
It's wonderful to have you here. I think the last time you were on our program was when your book came out.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a while ago.
That would have been 2010, yeah.
That's a long time ago. So yep. It's nice to have you back, and I just enjoy having your having you here and to talk about what's going on. Let me ask you, how did this particular event come about?
Well, you know, it almost always happens that I'm performing because someone saw me perform somewhere else.
Yeah.
And so that's probably what happened. I'm not sure. I'm also doing, as you had mentioned, a tour, well, specifically with the United Way over the past year or so. I've been doing, and I'm doing a lot of those as well. But this is separate. And I played Bard last year, and I'm guessing that's how Vassar found me.
Bard will lead to Vassar, or Vassar will lead to
right?
Bard.
Exactly.
Inevitably, that
yes.
will
yes.
that will happen.
Yep.
What is your connection to the area?
I live here.
Okay.
So I live near Stone Ridge. Moved up here full time in about 2012. Came up as a weekender from New York for a number of years, and then said, "Wait a minute, this is way better." And so my wife Jennifer and I moved up and. So it's home, and we do a lot of work in Kingston with the foundation work, and just love the area.
You talk about this. I mean, I alluded to it in the introduction, but you tell stories about growing up and career choice and philanthropic learning, and that phrase philanthropic learning is interesting to me. Did you come up with that phrase? Did you coin that phrase?
Well, I will say that I coined a phrase, I think I coined it in any way, in 2013 when I wrote a New York Times op-ed called The Charitable Industrial Complex. I'll take credit for that phrase.
Yep.
And the phrase that went along with it in there, conscience laundering. All that to say that, I basically recently became Warren Buffett's son. This is not something that followed me around. Everybody thought I was related to Jimmy Buffett forever. And then my dad does his big gift. And generally over the last 15 years, he's gotten much more well-known. And therefore, I've been more of a curiosity than I used to be. And with that came his big gift in 2006, where he decided to give all his money away, which we knew that was going to happen. But we didn't know, my siblings and I, there's three of us, I'm the youngest, we did not know we'd play such a big role. And in 2006, he made the gift of a $1 billion foundation. And you can imagine when you have a $1 billion foundation, you're better looking, your jokes are funnier.
Right.
Yeah. And you see a lot. You can see a lot if you choose to look, because with a lot of money, you can give it to a lot of places. But if you choose to look and you go to Liberia, you go to Bangladesh, you go to where our shirts come from, you go to where, you see under this system of global markets, essentially, the philanthropy, you learn a lot. But you also recognize this is a patch. This system created philanthropy, actually, and it's all part of the system, and it's not good.
Talk a little bit about that system, because we hear the ups of that system, we hear the downs of that system, of how it all filters through, and it seems to me, not to undermine the work of any philanthropic organization, but there is this overarching theme of you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And again, where did the dollars of philanthropy come from? It came from
right.
the system. In the op-ed, I wrote, the left hand is trying to solve problems that the right hand created. And there's a lot of that going on. Philanthropy ultimately means the love of people. So it's actually not even about money, but money becomes the major tool of it. And again, plenty of good work for sure. But are you trying to stop the bleeding in ways, which is very important, very real needs right now? Or are you going upstream to figure out how the wound started? And if you start to look at that, you're going much, much deeper into the complexity and interrelatedness and entanglement of all these systems, mostly over the past 150 years or so, that have created the need for philanthropy. And that's, to me, the real issue is how badly it's needed, how woefully unprepared it is to really solve the deeper systemic problems. And here we are.
Your father is 89 years old, and but I assume these conversations, you say that you didn't realize what a large role you were going to take in this. But what were those conversations like of, as you say, you always knew that they were going to give the money away. But
right.
What were those conversations like? And ultimately, I guess that means what your father has felt his responsibility is as someone who, you know, has a net worth of $81 billion.
Right, exactly. You know, I mean, he would say, first of all, that he won, as did I, the ovarian lottery, you know, that we were born at a place at a time of a race and a class and all these things. But most importantly for him, I think, being born in 1930, white male with a brain that was wired for markets, essentially. He was born at the right time at the right place. As he says, if he was born, you know, 200 years ago, he'd be somebody's lunch or something. But he just had it in him. And what he knew or what he feels strongly about is that the society and culture that allowed him to do what he loves every day, you know, again, he's 89, he drives himself to the office every day, loves what he does, that culture should get its money back. Basically, he just had this amazing time, not unlike, you know, a pro baseball player or something. He was just really good at something. But the money wasn't the thing. He got to do it every day. The money piled up. And now that society should get its money back.
So what were your early years like in the sense of you finding yourself as to where what you were going to do and what your role as a human being was going to be, as Peter Buffett was going to be, and as the son of Warren Buffett was going to be.
And all those things happened serially, I guess, because first it was being in a home. I grew up in the 60s, born in 1958, that was safe, and that was huge in retrospect. I realized the fact that I felt safe in my home. I had the same English teacher my mother had. I went to public school my entire childhood. My dad went to the office every day, home every day at the same time, dinner together at the dinner table. Extremely typical Omaha, Nebraska, white middle-class family. And so what I saw was a head of the household, we'll say, my dad coming home every day, but loving what he did. You know, he wasn't mad at the boss. He didn't need a drink to forget about the day. He loved it. And so I grew up in that. And I had no idea what he did. My sister had to fill out father's occupation in elementary school, and my mother suggested she write security analyst. And everybody thought he checked alarm systems. You know, we had no clue what my dad did. And yet he was happy. So the first rule around the house was find something you love to do. And I lived inside of that. And so that wasn't a stretch for me to think, okay, I'm going to see if I can figure out something that I really want to do. And, you know, my parents always said the money will follow and all that. And yet it took me into college to realize, oh, a music career is actually possible for me. But the other thing is, in retrospect with the philanthropy, is that in the 60s, my parents couldn't be more different, which is kind of a classic story of my dad's the, you know, breadwinner and goes to the office, and my mom's at home filling the house with love and loving everybody she meets and being this beautiful, bright human being. But and they certainly got along, but they really clicked deeply around social justice. And in the 60s, of course, you could go pretty far with that. And so that's what I felt as a kid. I felt parents that lit up when it came to social justice and equality issues. And that didn't really hit me until I got into the philanthropy side of life and went, oh, this is why I'm driven to be this way.
And this... how to ask this question. It seems like it's inevitable then, given your position and even given your father's position, that politics is going to get into it at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I've tried to stay, well, politics in terms of his versus mine, or
well,
because there is potentially that.
Yes, right? There is that. Mm-hmm. But also, I mean, what your goal of what you're doing is often in contrast to what is being done politically and nationally.
Right. Nicely said. Yes. And so for me, really, you know, we got this gift in 2006. We lived in New York City at the time. For the first 2 or 3 years, we just learned a ton because everybody comes through New York.
And this was shortly after your mom passed away.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. My mom passed away in 2004. And so a big change in my life in a number of ways. And so we learned a lot. We listened, traveled all over the world, and gathered that kind of information. And then... And reacted based on that in terms of the support we gave. And then I just am wild about history, basically. How did we get here? And so I did a lot of reading. And I'll tell you, once you read one Eric Foner book on Reconstruction, politics kind of goes out the window.
That's true.
Yeah. So I'm referencing, you know, at least 150 years of behavior as I'm thinking about where to put the money, because the systems we're in are entangled and overlapping and all built on the backs of a lot of people. And so I don't have a lot of faith in politics except local. You know, I think that there's got to be some. But the federal government, and I've been super involved as well with Indigenous people, both through my music and otherwise. This government hasn't done a very good job of acknowledging acknowledging, if nothing else. But, you know, the country was built on Indigenous land. And so the faith in the government following through in any meaningful way on that level escapes me. I mean, I just don't, I don't have that faith.
Peter Buffett is our guest in Studio A this morning. He will be performing a concert and conversation on Tuesday, the 3rd of March at 5:30 at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. And you can find out more by going to vassar.edu. The actual performance will take place in the Villard Room in the College Center. So this performance, when I say a concert and conversation, and as I mentioned in the introduction, the audience is a large part. They ask a lot of questions.
Right.
What do they want to know, Peter Buffett?
They want to know everything from, did you get an allowance to does your father approve of what you're saying, basically? Because I talk a lot about systems and structures and supply chains and you know what we're doing right now to people in the name of capitalism, for instance, or you know the politics, whatever it might be. And it's interesting because I take quite a few questions through the show, and people, of course, invariably will ask me, what are some of the questions you get? And it's a cop-out, I guess, but I am so in the show at that moment. I'm now having somebody write down the questions because I don't remember after the show.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I know.
I'm just in it, right?
Yes, I do the same thing here. They come in, they go out, and you don't remember them. But but certainly themes evolve, and I would think that given what you're doing, it must be interesting because, as you say, you get this gift, and then you go out, and you're really the messenger. You're the one going out and doing it, and the disciple, if you will.
Right.
And so the obvious question that would come, I would think, would be, what does Dad make of this as he's sending you out into the world to preach this message.
Yeah, and it's he saw the show, he's seen it a few times. He saw it most recently because the show changes. It's the same format, but of course times change, and so the show changes.
Right.
And so he saw it last fall and was extremely encouraging, and also knowing that he's sitting in the audience, and I'm saying this system doesn't work for too many people, and here's why, and follow a supply chain back, and I'll give you an example, and I'll show you how, you know, this or that is not about reform. We have to actually completely restructure certain things from the ground up, and he approves of the message. because that lives in him, because I know him so well, you know, from the 60s and beyond, and I've seen some of the things he's done back then and all that. And at the same time, now he's sort of the you know, the jolly uncle that's going to tell you everything's going to be okay. You know, he's sort of the propaganda minister of capitalism at this point in terms of saying
that. Well, that's a great way of putting it. I'm curious about that because, you know, I think especially over the last couple of debates, but, you know, I mean, you know this probably better than anybody else. A lot of times billionaires are vilified. And your father, while certainly there have been slings and arrows, comes out as a very well respected elder statesman who is looked at as, okay, while we're having this discussion, yes, but what does Warren Buffett make of this?
Right, exactly. And it's fascinating because I am able to obviously, I know him pretty well. I grew up in the house, and I know he's a good guy. I know he's a nice guy. I know he has a big heart. I know he cares, all these things. And so I get to be the representative of like you're saying, the, you know, this example now, or certainly the strata of humans in the billionaire class that I think should be questioned quite deeply. And yet I also see to some extent the secret of his success. And it's interesting because, you know, you usually make a lot of money because you invent something or you come up with a better version of something, whether it's Steve Jobs or Jeff Bezos or, you know, they made something and it spits out a lot of money.
And your father's the foundation has done a lot of work through the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
My father has given a large part of the money to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
So it goes through that.
It goes to them, exactly, right. Just as it comes to us or my sister or my brother. Yeah.
So I just have to ask this question, but what does your dad make of Bernie Sanders?
That's a good question, actually, because I don't know at this moment. I would say I knew 6 or 8 months ago, but I don't know.
Well, and the message hasn't changed a great deal.
Yeah, right. And I would think he would feel how most establishment people feel. You know, I don't want to put words in his mouth at all because it's been too long since I've talked to him about it. But I would not. It would not surprise me if he gave you... You know, I read David Brooks's column yesterday, I think, and you know, it's a very establishment response that, frankly, disturbed me a little bit because I think David Brooks is saying some great stuff, but there's a fear that he will up in the. I'm not saying my dad has that fear, but I'm saying that it wouldn't surprise me if there was that in him as well,
which makes sense.
Yeah,
makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. But I just want to finish that thought around the fact that most people invent or create things and make a lot of money. My dad has just made money off of money, right? He's a very unique character in terms of his wealth and how he accumulated it because he's not making anything.
Right.
And so that holds a certain kind of spot. And I will tell you that the way he's made it is through essentially isolation. He's done it by himself in his office, you know, with one partner, but basically doing it himself, and no real intimacy. I mean, he's really focused on what he does. And while he's close with people for sure, there's a certain kind of isolation that he's been able to make for himself. And that to me speaks to a fundamental issue with the culture is that it is through actually knowing people. There's a great line, I love it. It's the abstract without the particular allows the demonic. The abstract without, and I think that's what we're living in. We see these big, now even with coronavirus, we see these big numbers or small, we can't make sense really of what that means to us. And I think we're living in this world that is so abstract. That's why I think local politics are the only politics, because you're actually with the people, you meet the people, you feel what's going on. It's the problem of our time, I think.
Did you ever feel isolated from your father?
What a good question. My initial response would be no, because I knew where he was all the time and I knew he'd be accessible. I could call the phone number right now and he would answer. There would not be a, right? Yeah. So he's always there.
I wish you had told me that 12 minutes ago.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Right. Yeah, exactly. There's still time. Right. You know, so he was always there, and yet he was also always in his head. And He would never be angry about being interrupted. He'd always welcome it. He's, to this day, he's always got time. So there's a certain real connection there in terms of knowing. But he's also always in his head and knows what he needs to know.
But family was important.
Yes, absolutely.
Family is very important.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned coronavirus, and I do have to ask about that. Of how does that come onto the radar? We're seeing this play out in real time, and you're watching it, and it's, and you wonder. So we don't know what it's going to be. If it's going to be, the next horrible thing that we're going to know about for hundreds of years from now, or that it's going to be a blip and go away in a matter of months. So when it comes to a foundation response, how do you gauge that and know? It's sort of like asking a historian about how much do you pay attention to current events.
Exactly. Well, and that's what I struggle with over all because of my love of history. I feel like we're in an arc of history. We just haven't named it yet. You know, and the internet is the printing press and all these things where we're in something. And so the coronavirus is something where, honestly, that's not what our specialty is. I do think philanthropy should pay attention to what it knows best, if it knows anything at all. And so, for instance, the Gates Foundation is all up inside, viruses and vaccines and all these kinds of things. So I could see where they could, and they have the money. I mean, they could put literally hundreds of millions of dollars into something.
And they have a response team. I mean, that's what they're set up to
do. Yeah. And we really aren't. I mean, if there's an emergency in a place that we're familiar with and we know the people, we will try and get money there for sure. But it's not our area of expertise, basically.
Your event at Vassar takes place March 3rd at 5:30. So what can people expect?
They will expect myself on piano, my dear friend Michael Cott, who's worth the price of admission, even if it's free, tremendous cellist, and a lot of conversation and a lot of surprises. I will give away the fact that I show my father's middle school report card. I won't tell you anything else, but that seems to be a highlight for parents and students alike.
Bet it was for him, too.
And lots of fun stories, and also quite real stories. That's the other part of it. It starts out kind of friendly and loose and lots of funny things, but it gets pretty intense because we need some clarity, I think, right now around what's really happening and how deep this trench is that we've sort of built in America and beyond through our behavior for hundreds of years.
The last question I have for you, which is the artsy question that I love to ask, which is, but all that you're doing is that music can get through that.
Right.
I mean, that's incredible.
Even I'm amazed at that. Yeah. I mean, I've done this show for 10 years, and like you had mentioned, in China and all these places, and I am still surprised at how music can set up a room and a feeling, and then you just go right through and with the message, and it strikes people differently because of it.
Peter Buffett will perform a concert and conversation on Tuesday, March 3rd at 5:30 at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. It's happening in the Vard Room in the College Center. If you go to vassar.edu, you can find out more information about the event. You can also go to our website, which is wamc.org/roundtable, and click on there, and you will also be able to hear this conversation once again. Peter Buffett, what a joy to have you. Thank you so much for chilling with us for a half hour.
You.
I really appreciate your conversation.
Thank you. Likewise, I'm just an hour away, so
excellent.
Anytime.
Well, we'd love to have you back. Thank you very
great.
Much.
Thanks.
Again, Peter Buffett in concert, a concert and conversation, Tuesday, March 3rd at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.